Support for the full story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
All right. It's the end of a busy week, and as such, it's time for the weekly news roundup. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org and also on the WSHU app. I'm Ron Ropiak, and as usual, there's a lot to get to today. But we're going to start with the elections that took place this past week. And to guide us through the races in Connecticut, we have Ken Dixon and Caitlin Krasselt from Hearst Connecticut Media. Ken, Caitlin, thanks for being here. How are you?
Hi, Ron.
Great. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Caitlin, mm-hmm. Let's start with Bridgeport. Mayor Joe Ganim, the incumbent, he wanted to get reelected. So what happened?
He did. Ken has really been the one in the trenches in Bridgeport, but he was pretty easily reelected despite a write-in campaign by State Senator Marilyn Moore. Ken, how many votes did she end up getting on that write-in campaign?
She got exactly half of what Joe Ganim got, and that's pretty. That's more than I think even her closest team could have counted on, could have hoped for, because she failed to get 207 petition signatures to get her own ballot line.
That's a pretty good number of write-in signatures, though. Not discredit that.
No, I'm not discrediting it at all. But the fact remains that if she had her own line on the ballot instead of doing this convoluted fill in the bubble and write my name way down at the bottom, she could have bumped off Ganim. It would have been historic.
Caitlin, talk to us about everything that happened over the last few weeks. I mean, going all the way back to the primary, what happened?
In Bridgeport?
Yes.
Ken was really on the ground in Bridgeport.
How about Colebrook, Caitlin? What happened up in Colebrook? Can we find that on the map?
I don't know what happened in Colebrook.
All right, so Ken, what happened with the primary?
State Senator Marilyn Moore won on the machine, stunning the Democratic machine, the not-so-well-oiled machine. And we were able to uncover a lot of ballot irregularities in the absentee ballot dissemination and apparent illegalities also. She couldn't get enough petition signatures, and she did this. She went for this write-in campaign that showed how vulnerable Ganim really is. I mean, he only won 2-1 over her, and it's kind of a variation on the theme when he took his $1 million summer vacation in 2018 to challenge Ned Lamont for the gubernatorial primary. He got 5,200 votes to 2,300. There's some dissatisfaction in there. He talks about education, taxes, and safety, and he hasn't been able to deliver really anything in this Joe Ganim 2.
So what went on in the Democratic primary, just to clarify it, is that Marilyn Moore won the vote that was cast but lost in the absentee ballots.
Right. She won by like 340 votes on the machines, but the Democratic town committee operatives papered the city with hundreds, if not thousands, of absentee ballot applications, and they were persuading people send in this absentee ballot application. We'll have it all filled out for you, your name and address, and we'll even invent a reason why you're not going to be in town to do the election and for election day. And that's blatantly illegal.
It went to court. Some voters were dissatisfied. What did the judge rule?
The judge pointed out the need for big changes like no excuse absentee ballots, early voting, and he was basically hamstrung because in this hastily put together lawsuit, the plaintiffs, a couple of activist organizations in town, could not come up with enough instances to overturn the 270 vote margin of victory that Joe had via 967 absentee ballots to Marilyn Moore's 313.
So, Caitlin, now that we're at the end and everything has been decided, are any changes? Is there any talk about changing anything to the absentee ballot procedures?
That's something that good government activists have really been pushing for even before this kind of absentee ballot scandal in Bridgeport. And it was something that they worked really, really hard on in the spring during the legislative session and just were unable to get through for a variety of reasons. They are really pushing for things like automatic voter registration, which would mean that, you know, essentially in any interaction you have with government in which you give them your information, you could check a box and you would automatically be registered to vote. And, you know, they want things like early voting and, you know, like Ken said, the fewer restrictions on who's allowed to vote absentee. And all of those things would help alleviate some of these problems because it would cut down on election day registration, which is where a lot of lines build up. And it would, you know, early voting and eliminating restrictions on absentee voting would allow more people to vote because when you are restricted on when you can vote absentee and when you're restricted to just one day between the hours of 6 a.m. and 8 p.m. to voting, for some people, that can be really, really challenging. And so I think this scandal in Bridgeport has really kind of given those good government activists some more ammunition for their cause. But as for whether or not we'll actually see any of those reforms passed in the next session, I'm just not sure.
Judge Stevens also wants to ban the absentee ballot application process from political operatives, where they've been playing fast and loose. The case has also went to the Supreme Court in a last-ditch effort to actually stop the election. This was Monday, and the election was Tuesday, and the judges just couldn't do that. But the case is still alive, and we're waiting for some kind of possible remanding back to the lower court to explore another statute that gets murky. Ron?
I have about 4 minutes left in the segment. Could we talk about New Haven for a second? The incumbent Tony Harp wanted another term. Ken, what happened there?
Well, I mean, she decisively lost the primary then to this Justin Elliker, and she was... Yeah, she's 72. She had a string of victories. She's a former heavy-hitting appropriations chair up in the legislature as a state senator. So she thought about it for a while, and she said, well, I'm on the Working Families Party line anyway. Might as well just kind of, like, keep this going. And then she got crushed on Tuesday night.
Caitlin, Tony Harp has been around for a while, and she helped Ned Lamont get out the vote and become governor. Was she owed some loyalty from Ned Lamont and his supporters?
That's a good question, owed loyalty. I think it all depends on how you look at it. Lamont didn't do a ton of campaigning really for anyone. He showed up in a few places kind of toward the end, but it was really the Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicevic that made the rounds in the last few months. And I don't know the reason for that. There's some speculation that it could have to do with his polling numbers, but I'm not sure. And a lot of people withheld endorsements in New Haven prior to the primary, which was definitely an interesting component.
Ken, in terms of the vote on Tuesday, did anything strike you in terms of the reaction from President Trump and his coattails? Did you see anything affecting the vote in Connecticut?
Actually, Caitlin dove into that more than I did.
Anecdotally, talked to a lot of voters who said, a lot of Democratic voters who said, you know, I am determined to show him, you know, that even at the local level, you know, he can't win or he can't do what he's doing. But at the end of the day, I don't know how much that actually affected any of the elections, because most of those people were people that were going to vote anyway, and they were going to vote Democratic anyway. So in terms of the actual result of the election, I don't know that we saw the so-called Trump effect really take hold anywhere. Both parties, Democrats and Republicans, flipped about a dozen seats each way, and there were a variety of reasons for that. In a couple of places, it had to do with local scandals, like you saw in Fairfield with that dumping hazardous waste scandal, and then up in Old Lyme, there was, of course, all of the problems with the Port Authority, which played a big role in that election. So I think at the end of the day, while there were some voters that felt that they were kind of sticking it to the president by voting Democratic, in municipal elections, all politics is local. And that's more what we saw in terms of the results.
That Old Lyme election, it was the selectman had been the head of the executive director, I think, of the Port Authority. And one of the troubles there was she used Port Authority money to buy artwork from her daughter to the tune of $3,000.
It's Ken Dixon and Caitlin Krassel. They're both with Hearst Connecticut Media. And now we're going to bring in Chris Keating. Chris is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Hartford Current. Hello, Mr. Keating. How are you?
How are you? How's things?
Things are good, thank you. Chris, we want to talk transportation for this segment because the big news obviously happened yesterday. Governor Ned Lamont has a new transportation plan. He just came out with it, even though it's been details of it have been leaking for the last few weeks. How much does he want to spend, and how does he intend to pay for it?
Well, it's a $21 billion plan, which is a large amount of money, 10 years, $21 billion. He wants to pay for some of it with tolls. They keep telling us that the tolls will not be a massive part of it. They're saying it'll be about 10%. It might actually be about 15% when the smoke clears. But it's a combination of low-interest federal loans, and then you would use the tolls to pay back those loans over a period of 27 years. So it's a little bit complicated.
27 years. Hey, Caitlin, can you give us a recap by either you or Ken? I mean, what happened to the first transportation plan? What happened to that?
The first five transportation plans?
Well, yeah, the variations on them. What happened to them, Caitlin?
They went nowhere.
Like traffic on I-95 in rush hour.
Could be.
Yeah, they've kind of stalled on the highway. the plan, I guess, that was most recently proposed in the spring had, I think, 50 or 60 tolls. There weren't a ton of details provided on where exactly that money would go and what exactly it was going to be used to fix. And the rollout of that plan was, I think, as we all might remember, a little bit sloppy and unclear what the goals were. And this one is, I will say, completely different. They have put up a website that is very, very detailed in terms of what each, you know, dollar will essentially pay for on the highways, railways, airports, and surrounding communities. As they're impacted. So at least to that degree, this one is much, much more detailed.
Well, the airports and ports are kind of left hanging there on that nice little website, but the interactivity is pretty interesting.
But it sounds like they finally got their act together in terms of marketing, because they have to learn how to sell this. But Ken, let me ask you, those opposed to the first plan said, no tolls. No matter what, no tolls. This new plan has tolls. Not as many as the first one, but it has tolls. Why would this plan succeed if the first plan did not?
I think maybe some of the Republican opponents are realizing that, maybe this isn't like the best issue to run a 2020 House and Senate race. I think maybe they're the PR might be shifting. I mean, it's easy to be no. It's easy to kind of try to scare the Democrats in an election year, and they might be running out of road here, so to speak, Ron.
Hey, Chris, the governor is trying hard. I mean, he's trying hard to sell this plan, even saying that tolls are no longer tolls. They are quote-unquote user fees. But if I'm going to paraphrase anyone, I'm going to use Gertrude Stein, because a toll is a toll is a toll, right? No matter what you call it?
Yes, I think most of the general public will be using the word tolls. I haven't heard anyone else use the word user fees except the Lamont administration. So I don't think anybody either in the newspapers or on talk radio or wherever, everyone knows what a toll is, and it's a toll.
Ken, this latest plan, from what I was reading, and I wasn't able to go through every single page of the proposal, but it seems to have a lot of business for Fairfield County, for Lower Fairfield County. Is that because he's trying to get the Republican legislators in Lower Fairfield County to come over to his side of the road?
What do you mean a lot of business, Ron? Sorry.
Repairing the bridges.
Well, that's you know, one of the most heavily traveled areas of the state. I mean, you know, the rail lines alone, there are 400-year-old bridges, you know, on the Metro North line. And it's just going to, if they don't do it quickly, they're going to be, you know, $600 million a year behind. It's pretty dire. And maybe that's the challenge facing Governor Lamont, to try to disseminate this down. So, like, the average person on the parkway who's, like, looking at the bumper in front of him at 5 miles an hour at 7 in the morning can understand.
Caitlin, what are you hearing when you're talking with people, even with friends and so on? What do they think about tolls?
That's actually really interesting. I live in Stamford, and I commute up to Hartford. And, you know, most people that I talk to don't really understand why we don't have tolls. And these are people that are, like, not at all involved in politics. Like, they don't even read my stories half the time. Like, they're just, you know, general commuters who work in a variety of industries. And it is a little bit kind of baffling to be the only state that doesn't have tolls. I drove into New York once last month and I paid $14 in tolls. I paid nothing to drive on Connecticut's roadways. I do. I pay the gas tax and a variety of other things. But the opposition, the no tolls opposition, is, it seems to be a very loud, vocal, but very small group.
Chris, one part of the story that Ken mentioned before, and I think it somewhat got buried, even though it's getting a bit more traction today. One part of this story is that the state and the Lamont administration wants a study done to see if another major airport can be put in either Stratford or New Haven. And this would be the second one after Bradley up in Windsor Locks. Now, the governor has said that there's a desperate need for another major airport in Connecticut. But my question is, we're talking about the roadways around here, and as Ken mentioned, you know, at 7 in the morning, everyone around here is doing 5 miles per hour, 10 miles per hour, tops maybe. So with the roads so clogged, how can you go and put another major airport in an area that's already clogged?
Yeah, and an airport is very, very difficult. Even Lamont people will tell you, you can't just turn a switch and overnight make yourself into a gigantic airport. People are children and parents of habit. In other words, people downstate in Greenwich who have been going to LaGuardia Airport and Kennedy Airport for years, or even Westchester County Airport, are not overnight just suddenly going to go to Sikorsky. Also, getting the airlines in there. So it seems to be a laudable goal, and they are going to try to do it. Don't get me wrong. But that's a very, very, very long-term project to change people's attitudes, to change travel patterns, and most importantly, to get the airlines in to make the whole thing work. It's not easy at all, and it's probably it's more difficult than it sounds.
There's serious neighborhood opposition in both airports, too. I mean, it took 10 years for Bridgeport to get a little of Stratford's Main Street put in like another 100 yards just for a safety zone, not even a landing zone, a safety zone. There was a multi-fatal there in the late 90s. Yeah.
And I'm doing this from memory
now.
And
could I add one point?
Sure.
Yeah. If I could add one point on that also, Justin Elliker was just elected as the mayor of New Haven. And Elliker's position is that basically in 20 years, Tweed New Haven Airport is going to be underwater.
It's going to be underwater, they've been saying. Right.
Underwater. So if you've got your mayor there, he's not a huge fan of extending the runways or expanding the airport, particularly it's on the water, as you know, and particularly if it's going to be underwater.
So Sikorsky, too, for that matter. A high tide will starts washing up against the end of one of the...
Exactly, with global warming and climate change. And we've talked about this numerous times on this program. Both those areas are in the flood zones, and as the Sound comes up. So that's why I was reading this, and I know I have to do more reading into it. I'm wondering how they're coming up with these two areas that are already facing some serious issues.
Well, maybe they can just put the properties over to the Port Authority, Ron. There you go.
Caitlin, for months now, we've heard about a special session being called to resolve a number of unresolved issues. And we started talking about this, gosh, I think it was back in June. And we said, okay, there's going to be a special session in July. Then we had a program we said in August and September, October. Basically, we've run out of runway, so to speak. Any chance at all of a special session being called to resolve these issues and transportation before the end of 2019?
Well, it's almost the middle of November. So we're getting into holiday season. And based on my conversations with people, I would not hold my breath for any sort of special session. I don't know if Ken and Chris have heard differently, but...
Well, the hospital stuff hasn't been hammered out yet. The governor's still at war over the debt diet. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, well, the general rule, the closer and closer you get to the holidays, the less interest there is among the legislators, and also the attendance goes down. You certainly can't have a special session on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. The interest in it goes down. If they really had their ducks in line, both on the hospitals, the restaurants, all these issues, the bond package, everything we're talking about, you could have had a special session in September or October. But if you're trying to have something on Christmas Eve, it's not going to happen.
And so if this doesn't happen, we're talking about February, right, when the next session is scheduled to start?
Yeah, right, which pushes everything to May or late April because it's the short session.
Chris, in terms of this transportation plan, I know Republicans have been working on their own plan. They have floated one in the past. Any idea of when we may see a new one coming from the GOP?
Well, we asked about that just yesterday. They didn't have a time frame for us, but you are correct. They said they are working on it behind the scenes. If you think about it for a minute, Lamont's been working on this thing for months, and he has a gigantic state budget office called OPM in the nomenclature up here. Fasano was saying the other day he doesn't have an OPM to gather all numbers and things for him. So the short answer is they're working on it, but no, we have not been given a precise time frame on when that might be out.
And Len Fasano is Len Fasano, who's the Senate Minority Leader. Ken, this latest proposal has some hefty support from some business leaders, but the past proposal was actually shot down by the CBIA, the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. What do they have to say about this new proposal? Have they said anything?
They were not there. Chris, did you call them for a react on that? I haven't read your story.
I did not talk to them.
Yeah, Ned had his supporters there, and it was off campus, too. So, yeah, that's a good question, Ron.
I
think the business community in general is very, very split. The reason why CBIA didn't really say much for years on tolls was because the membership of CBIA couldn't agree. I'm talking, over a period of the last 5 years, for example. In other words, the membership of CBIA wants the roads fixed, but a lot of the members, as you can imagine, disagree over whether tolls are a good idea or a bad idea. So you can trot out some business leaders who say it's a good idea, but on the flip side, you can trot out a lot of people who say it's a bad idea.
Well, Joe McGee from the Fairfield County Business Council was there yesterday, and they've been pretty solid for years about the need for tolls. That's just paralyzing southwestern Connecticut in a big way, and he's one of Lamont's biggest supporters on this, and he had a lot of interesting things to say yesterday.
And Joe and others have been backing this for a while, too, because part of this proposal is to get the ride from Stamford into New York City down to 30 minutes, mm-hmm. which they say would really get people off the roads and finally onto the trains.
Well, Ned's ratcheting that back a little more realistically to 10 to 15 minutes quicker.
Caitlin,
the 30, if I could add the 30 minutes, that would be very, very quick. If you want to, anybody who's ever ridden the trains, you would have to have, that would have to be a major express. You basically couldn't stop anywhere except maybe 125th on the way down. A half an hour would be amazing.
Exactly. Not only that, they would have to straighten out a lot of the lines just to make it to give it a straight run into there, because if you go around those turns, you have to slow down. It's simple there. Final question, because we're almost out of time. Caitlin, what about the trust factor when it comes to this transportation plan? I mean, why should legislators and others trust the Lamont administration to do what they say they're going to do, that they're going to spend the money that they're promising under this new plan?
The reason that this plan is garnering a little bit more support is that those low-interest federal loans are very specific about what the money can be used for, and in terms of paying it back, you have to prove a dedicated funding stream in order to even qualify for the loans, and that's where the tolls, user fees come into play. But that is going to be a huge hurdle for the Lamont administration to get over that trust factor, because it's really just not there. I mean, I spoke to many Republican legislators yesterday who said I agree with the priorities in terms of the projects that need funded, but I just don't trust that these tolls will ever come down. And so at the end of the day, you know, while they think that this, you know, is a good, detailed, well thought out plan, it's going to be really, really challenging to convince a lot of them to get on board with even one poll.
That is the tiniest fig leaf.
That is something that they know that they have to deal with.
That's the tiniest fig leaf that they have to stand behind. It's like the taxpayers, the voters trusted Lamont and they elected him, and he should be given a chance to actually do what he was elected for.
Chris, we have about a minute left. In terms of the trust factor, is that something that can be overcome?
It's a gigantic issue. It cannot be underestimated. A lot of people just don't believe. They don't believe, number one, that the toll prices would never increase. Ned's saying he wants a 10-year freeze on the prices. Number two, they don't believe that the tolls would ever come down once they go up. One thing to remember is it's the 27-year payback period for these federal loans. So what happens in year 27? It's not like the tolls will come down in 5 years. You won't have paid back the loans by then. So 27 years is a long year, a long way away, and we might not be talking on the radio in 27 years.
In fact, the lifetime of a gantry is 10 years. So, it's like no one should even say that the tolls are going to come down ever.
Ken Dixon, Caitlin Krassel, Hearst Connecticut Media. Ken, thank you. Caitlin, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Chris Keating, Capital Bureau Chief for the Hartford Current. Chris, always a
thank
pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend. Thank you, Kenny.
Thanks, Ron.
Let's turn our attention now to a few New York stories. One of them has to do with the vote this past Tuesday that returned Steve Ballone to office for another term as Suffolk County Executive. WSHU's Jay Shaw is with us to tell us more. Hey, Jay, how are you?
I'm great, Ron. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Whom did Mr. Ballone defeat?
Mr. Ballone defeated Republican John Kennedy Jr. The campaign mainly focused on county finances, water quality, and just efforts to sort of maintain Long Island's workforce, because one of the main problems Long Island's facing right now is that young people are leaving and the population that's staying is getting older.
As in many other places, that's happening a lot in Connecticut and New York. What were the numbers? What were the final numbers for the vote?
Well, Ballone won with about 53% of the vote, and Kennedy received about 45%.
And could you run down the major talking points again? I know finances had a lot to do with it, but we spoke with Lane Filler from Newsday the other day, and he was saying that voters were concerned about other issues, and maybe finance wasn't at the top.
Yes, well, slowly and slowly, I think the water quality issue on Long Island is becoming more and more of a... More and more people are becoming aware of that issue, and that's becoming a factor in who they vote for. Long Island is on an aquifer, and because of Suffolk County's system of sewers, septic systems are sort of leaching nitrogen into the aquifer and sort of making the water drinking water quality worse and worse. So that's a problem that's going to continue to get worse, and different officials have different ways of going about how to solve that issue.
And just to do a little promo for ourselves, in the next week or two, we're probably going to have a program about the water quality issue again, and I believe it's going to be on Tuesday, as our producer J.D. Allen tells me in my headphones, so I hope everybody tunes in for that one. Jay, was the outcome of the vote a surprise to you?
Well, not to me. It just seemed that Ballone had a significant financial backing in comparison to Kennedy, and Ballone has been in power for at least two terms, and returning to his third and final term seems to make sense because it felt like Suffolk County voters wanted that stability and maintaining the course that Ballone set.
Talk to us a little bit about the term limits.
Well, this is Ballone's final term. He will not be allowed to run for county executive again, at least.
And now that it is his final term, has he put the order in for his priorities? What's number one, number two, number three?
Well, he says that his main priority is going to be maintaining the current course they're on. I know Suffolk County recently passed a budget that involves more, you know, financing for water quality and sewer infrastructure throughout Suffolk County as well. Water quality seems to be the main issue, as well as maintaining Long Island's working age population.
And Jay, finally, before we move on to another topic, there has been talk for quite some time that Steve Ballone has his eyes on other offices. Any more talk about that? And what office would it be?
I don't want to presume or assume anything. I think from the conversations I've had with him, he seems fairly intent on finishing out his term for the next 4 years as county executive.
Okay. Now, before I let you go, can we spend a few minutes talking about something that's extremely worrisome to baymen and women and environmentalists, and it concerns Peconic Bay and the scallop population? What is going on? What happened this year?
Well, the past Monday, baymen were reporting that there was a massive die-off over the summer for the scallops in the Peconic Bay, which is it's a significant portion of the larger scallop harvest on Long Island, at least. And there are, at least the people I spoke to, including John Dunn, who was the East Hampton Town's shellfish hatchery director, he says that the usual suspects of the die-off are not really present. There weren't any major algal blooms, and there aren't any signs of predators coming in and eating and destroying the shellfish. So what they're thinking is that it might be related to climate change, which is causing higher and higher temperatures within the waters of the bay, which is essentially suffocating the shellfish.
So higher temperatures and less oxygen, and that's what's doing it?
Well, that's the presumption right now. They say there needs to be way more research, a lot more research, and that involves, you know, testing for water quality on a regular basis. And that would require, you know, partnerships between the state, between researchers, between local business officials.
Is this just happening on Long Island? I saw a New York Times report that said bay scallops in Massachusetts were okay. So is this just around Peconic Bay and those waters?
Well, it's mainly being concentrated around the Peconic Bay. The commercial shellfishing seasons are opening up around various waters over the next month or so. This Monday, waters in East Hampton are opening up as well. The person I spoke to, he mentioned that the scallops in the harbors are okay right now. But again, those are not a significant portion. Those numbers are not anything compared to what could have happened in the Peconic Bay.
So what are the experts telling you? Will the scallop population come back next year on its own, or will it require human intervention?
It's going to require a lot of luck, I think. the people I spoke to says that say that there needs to be a lot more research done. And on top of that, it's just a matter of climate change making things worse. And as things get worse, it's harder to reset to the original healthy ecosystem.
This has a huge impact on the local economy, doesn't it?
Again, one person I spoke to said that at one point, you know, towns would shut off their people who were living in that town would shut off pretty much everything else they were doing just to go scalping because that's their that's their blood and life.
So and for some scalpers, what they do now impacts what they have over the winter time. I mean, it's a huge chunk of the financial budget there.
Right. And because of the damage being done now, we don't know what the future looks like for them.
Is there any word on what this will do to the price of scallops when you and I go to the market?
Well, the thing is, we might not see it right away because some fishermen might find scallops further into the sea or find other sources temporarily, but that would be a Band-Aid on the larger wound.
WSHU reporter Jay Shaw. Thanks, Jay. I appreciate it. Have a nice weekend.
Of course, you too. Have a great day.
Thanks. And finally, we want to spend a few minutes talking with Michael O'Keefe. Mike writes for Newsday, and he keeps an eye on, police-related stories. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I hope you're well. On this show in the past, we've talked about the opioid epidemic and the destruction that's obvious to many of us, the destruction it's caused throughout our region and the country. Now, just the other day, there was a huge bust in Nassau County that involved fentanyl. Mike, first, what is fentanyl and how much was seized?
Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. Much of it that's in the United States comes from China. It is extremely powerful, many, many times much more powerful than morphine or heroin. And it is often used by drug traffickers, drug dealers to cut heroin, to get more bang for the buck. It's a pretty inexpensive drug to purchase. And so they use it to cut the drugs that they're selling to people and get more bang for their buck.
Just out of curiosity, when they're selling this heroin, do they tell the people that they're selling it to that this actually has fentanyl in it, or are they telling them this is pure heroin?
I mean, that's the problem, and I don't think that, you know, I think that a lot of the people who we've talked to who have survived overdoses of this stuff, they did not know that it was cut with fentanyl. It's not something that gets advertised. And I mean, that's one of the problems. And there have actually been people in Suffolk County here on Long Island who have been charged with manslaughter for selling someone what they thought was heroin, and then it turned out to be fentanyl, and that person died. So it is a really significant problem in terms of the opioid epidemic, not only on Long Island, but around the country.
Can you tell me how much was seized?
Yeah, there were 400 grams worth about $130,000. It was I could talk a little bit about the operation if you'd like.
Sure, please.
An effort by this stemmed from a investigation by the Nassau County District Attorney's Office, the federal ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the FBI. They have a task force on Long Island dealing with guns and gangs. And this came out of a investigation into street crime in Hempstead. They were looking to get drugs and guns off the street, and they, while investigating a drug ring, they learned about this. They learned that there was a gentleman who was being incarcerated on heroin charges. He was serving a 22-year sentence in Massachusetts. When they arrested him, he was in Massachusetts. When they started investigating this, he was in Massachusetts. But he was directing this from his jail cell, from a prison, using a prison phone.
And 400 grams, just so we can do it for those who may not know the metric system so much, 400 grams is actually less than a pound, right?
Yeah, but it's a very powerful amount of drugs. The district attorney said that the amount they seized had a potential 150,000 potential fatal overdoses. So you know, this is a lot of fentanyl to get off the street, and a lot of people hopefully are not going to die because of this seizure.
It's when I was reading your story, it occurred to me, as I'm sure it occurred to many others. I mean, how do you find something that's less than a pound? I mean, it's so incredibly easy to hide.
The way this happened was police, you know, the authorities didn't say how they got into this case, but what I suspect, they talked about him using a prison phone to direct other people. And what I suspect happened was that they overheard him telling somebody that I have this heroin. They originally thought it was heroin. The guys who bought it thought it was heroin. So, I mean, it was, they were fooled by that as well. But I think they overheard him ordering someone to take this heroin that had been stored in a house and then sell it. It turned out to be fentanyl. But they were following these people, and they basically stopped one of them on a traffic stop and were able to seize the drugs that way. And then during a subsequent search of a home, they found more of the fentanyl. So it was a 400-gram total seizure, but they found it in two different places.
Mike, what are officials and experts telling you about the opioid epidemic on Long Island? Is the situation improving with all the attention that has been paid to it over the last year or two?
Yeah, we've seen in the last year that fatal overdoses are declining, and that's the good news. But, you know, it's still, they haven't declined significantly. There are people still dying from opioid overdoses on Long Island. I think Narcan has had a lot to do with it. I think the distribution of Narcan, that drug users, their families, as well as, you know, just like facilities like schools or hospitals or police station, have much more accessibility than Narcan. Narcan is a drug that reverses the effects of an opioid overdose. So I think that does have a big impact on Long Island and elsewhere as well. I think also the education and the law enforcement part is starting to connect, and we're starting to see some progress here. But it's slow, and it could be reversed.
What about the people who live in the area where the drug bust took place? What was the area like? What did they tell you or tell the officers who were there?
Well, you know, Hempstead is it's a tough neighborhood. It's a tough area. Parts of it are anyway. There is, persistent crime there. There is gang activity. What the police commissioner, Patrick Ryder in Nassau County, said at the press conference was that residents of the neighborhood where the police were focusing these investigations on wrote a letter. 500 people signed a letter thanking the police for their involvement in this. So I think people in that community are welcoming this sort of law enforcement intervention. They're the first people impacted by this. They're the ones who are the victims of crime by the drug users who are trying to get money to support their habits. They are the ones who are finding needles and things like that in their yards and on their streets. So, I think that they were very thankful, at least according to the police commissioner, that the police are intervening in this.
It's nice to hear, but at the same time, I know from other shows that we've done and from what people have told us that some who live in such areas at times can be fearful about speaking out.
Yeah, the police have not always had a good relationship with people in those communities, and so there is always going to be some suspicion, at least until, there's a fundamental tension between communities like Hempstead around the country and police departments, and I don't see that changing anytime soon, but I do think that people are... everybody wants their kids to be safe. No one wants to see their kids playing in streets with needles on them or with people buying drugs or things like that. And so I think there is a fear of the gangs, and of course there's a distrust of the police. But I think we're seeing some progress in that area.
Michael O'Keefe from Newsday. Thanks, Mike. I hope you have a nice weekend.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. We're going to end our show today with a quick read of some of the emails and comments that we received in the last week about some of our programs. Now, for our program about teacher and parent stress, we received this. What about the fact that both parents have to work and young children spend most of their days in child care facilities. In our library, we can no longer offer Mommy and Me programs because those mommies are at work. For our Election Day show and trying to get people to actually turn out and vote in off years, Barbara wrote, "Hi, folks, wondering if you could discuss a national Election Day holiday. It seems like this is something our country should have." Speaking of elections, last Friday on our election preview show, we mentioned that John Kennedy, who we were just talking about, who was running at that time against Steve Ballone, had talked about a big illegal underground economy operating in Suffolk County. Now, we received this email in response to that. "Hi, Ron. I agree with the problem of the cash and illegal economy. Licenses are required for many trades like home improvement. My brother has been a painting and home improvement contractor for over 30 years. No license. I checked with the state because he was evasive on the topic. And guess what? No license. Contractors should collect sales taxes on work and pay taxes. Enforcement is light. Problems often only come if you advertise without a license." And finally, in response to our program on the rising number of suicides for young people, Moses left this comment on our Facebook page. "Hi, Ron. I just listened to the program you did on suicide. First, thank you for bringing attention to this. I would have liked to hear from someone in the adoption field to address the fact that the suicide rate is 4 times higher among adoptees versus non-adoptees. It is National Adoption Awareness Month, and I'm disheartened that adoptees are left out of these mainstream conversations even during its own awareness month. Please consider a show on adoption this month." Thank you, Moses, and to everyone else who called or wrote. Now, if you would like to add your comments about this program or about future programs, you can email us. We are at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you can leave a comment there, and you can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. And please remember that all our shows are available as podcasts. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank's a digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.